to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Dr. Susan Martin from the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University speaks on U.S. immigration policy challenges for the future. Dr. Susan Martin is the director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. She also directs the certificate program in refugee and humanitarian emergencies open to master level students at the university. A longtime expert on immigration and refugee policy, Dr. Martin came to Georgetown University after having served as the executive director of the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform, a bipartisan panel appointed by the president and congressional leadership. During this period, she also served as U.S. coordinator of the Binational Study on Migration between Mexico and the United States, a joint study with the Mexican government. Dr. Martin has conducted field-based research on refugee issues in Africa, Southeast Asia, and Central America, in addition to her work on U.S. and European immigration and refugee policy. She served as managing editor of the World Migration Report 2000, published by the International Organization for Migration and the United Nations. She is the author of Refugee Women and numerous articles on immigration and refugee policy. Dr. Martin co-chairs the Cooperative Efforts to Manage Immigration, an expert group that is identifying ways in which immigration destinations can work more effectively with source and transit countries to manage migration and reduce immigration pressures. On Friday, May 29th, she spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council on U.S. immigration policy, challenges for the future. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University, Dr. Susan Martin.
Thank you. I really appreciate the being here in Alaska and particularly talking about immigration issues. Maybe 20 years ago, immigration was an issue that affected maybe five or six states in the union. If you weren't from New York or California, Texas, Illinois, you really didn't care very much about immigration. It wasn't an issue that had very much import for most of the country. But things have changed, and today immigration has become a 50-state issue, and an issue that is an important one for our public policy agenda, for economy, for our social relations, community development. And I think it's particularly important for a discussion of immigration to be spread through the 50 states and for it to become part of the debate over the future of the country. And by a debate over the future of the country, I mean one that is very consistent with the values of the World Affairs Councils, one that seeks to understand the role of the United States in the world and the role that immigration plays as part of that, both domestic development as well as our international relations. I thought today I would start by talking a bit about the trends in immigration that have developed in this fourth wave of immigration that we've been experiencing since the 1970s, then talk somewhat about the challenges that we're facing as a country, and then conclude with some discussion of the prospects for reform of our immigration system, because I think the immigration system today is desperately in need of reform. It's not working as well as it should be, not serving either our domestic national interests or consistent with our role in the world. But on trends, currently there are almost 40 million foreign-born nationals living and residing in the United States. Again, as I mentioned before, those 40 million are spread throughout the country, with many new settlement areas having arisen over the past 20 years as immigration has filtered throughout the country. The major sources of immigration today are largely from Mexico, Latin America, and Asia, with smaller numbers coming from Africa and from Europe. So we've seen a shift in the composition of our immigration as compared to our first wave during the colonial period, which was largely Europe and Africa, our second wave, which was largely from Western Europe and the British Isles, and our third wave at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, which was largely from Southern and Eastern Europe. Shift in origins of immigrants is not new for us. As a country, we've seen that evolution in each of our major waves, and we're now in this most recent experience of the country as being a nation of immigrants, but from quite different regions than had been traditional in earlier waves of immigration. The 40 million are divided really into three almost equal categories. There are about 13 million who are in the country and have naturalized and are now U.S. citizens. About a third of the immigrants today in the U.S. have become part of the political and social economic mainstream of the United States. Another third are in the country legally. Vast majority of those are people who have come as permanent residents of the United States but have not yet naturalized. Many of those who haven't naturalized, it's because they're not yet eligible. They have come too recently, or they haven't yet learned enough English or enough about our history and civics to be able to go through the naturalization process. And, of course, there are also permanent residents who maintain strong ties to their home country and choose not to naturalize and be citizens of the U.S., sometimes not now, sometimes not ever. But a third of our immigrants are in that category. The last third are in the country without authorization. They're illegally resident in the United States. And they're divided into two groups. About 60% of them have, or 55-60% have crossed the U.S.-Mexico border, arrived without being inspected by any government official, usually with the help of smugglers who have gotten them into the country and then sent them on their way to just about every place one can find in the country, working in a variety of different occupations. The other 45% of those who are here illegally are believed to have entered with legal documentation. They came with visas, often as tourists or as business travelers or as students or workers, and then overstayed the terms of their visa or worked in violation of their visa and have remained here for some extended period. These three groups, the naturalized citizens, the permanent residents, and the unauthorized migrants, have all been long-term residents of the country. They've been, by long-term residents, they've been here at least 1 year, and in many cases for many years longer. There are, of course, a lot of people who come and go each year, who come in as tourists or as business travelers or come for studies and or for seasonal labor, and then return home within the course of the year, sometimes to circulate, come back the following year. But that's a very mobile population. But the almost 40 million are longer-term residents of the country. The immigrants today can be also divided in terms of the purpose of their or the reasons that they've come to the United States. Our largest legal admissions program is for family reunification or family formation. These are people who enter each year to join spouses, parents, children, brothers, sisters who are already living in the United States. Our legal permanent resident program admits usually about 700,000 or 800,000 people for family reunification each year. Others come in illegally also to reunify with family. Second major category are people who come specifically for work purposes. And there we don't, and I'll come back to this issue, don't actually have very many categories of legal admission for people who do all of the jobs in the United States that foreign workers tend to do. We have visa categories for those at the high end of the labor market, people with bachelor's degrees, master's, PhDs. But we have very, very few legal avenues of entry for people who have less than a bachelor's degree. And which, of course, as I'll come back to, is one of the reasons that we have developed such a large population of unauthorized or legal migrants, people coming in illegally, partly because there aren't legal systems for their admission. We also have categories for humanitarian purposes, mostly admission of refugees who come as a result of a fear of persecution, often because of their association with the U.S. government or because they are supporting democratic processes that get them into trouble with authoritarian dictatorial governments. And we have a small category called the diversity visa, which is a category that developed in order to be able to reopen migration from Europe and Africa, which had very small levels of immigration in the previous 40 years. And it's a very strange category. Other country in the world has one like it. There are 55,000 visas each year that are available to countries with very small levels of immigration to the U.S. And the choice of immigrants under the diversity system is done by lottery. And we get millions of applications each year for this very small number of visas. And it's largely, again, from Europe and from Africa where the roots of this immigration. The immigration that we have, by just about all economic analyses, show that there is a small but clearly positive impact of immigration today across all of these dimensions on the U.S. economy. And that's largely because the immigrants coming into the United States are different from natives, particularly in terms of their educational level. Whereas the majority of American residents of the United States, already residents, have a high school, 1 or 2 years, 3 years of college education. About 60% of the immigrants coming here have less than an elementary education, and about 25 or 30% have more than a college education or higher. In other words, they don't tend to compete with us, because whereas we're at the middle of the educational continuum, immigrants tend to either be much less well-educated than we are, taking jobs that, frankly, many Americans don't want to do under the wages and working conditions that are offered, or they're more educated than we are and are doing jobs where there aren't enough Americans who are trained and educated to do those occupations. So from an economics point of view, immigration is not a hugely significant issue. And it's not hugely significant because the numbers are still relatively small, given the size of our economy and the size of our workforce, but generally on the positive side. Where the concerns certainly come in, and particularly in places that are experiencing rapid growth in immigration, is more related to the social impacts. of having new communities who don't speak English, who require services in a foreign language, who require children require help learning English in school before they can progress through the systems. Communities unfamiliar with immigration often find themselves with difficulty in determining just what is the best way to help immigrants integrate into their societies. And Americans have always been highly ambivalent about immigration. We always look at our own immigrant forebears through rose-colored glasses. You know, we made America. We made it what it is. It was our immigrant forefathers who really conquered the country. But we've always been concerned about the current immigration. And that's as early as Benjamin Franklin in the 1970s, complaining that the German immigrants in Pennsylvania were never going to become English. This was before there was an America. Or the British immigrants and the German immigrants concerned about the Irish, or the Irish being concerned about the Italian or the Jewish or the Polish or the Russian immigrants. And so this is a process that we've gone through many times in the past and a process we're likely to go through in the future. Let me just say a word about the economic crisis, because clearly that affects both the impact of immigration, but also on the trends that I've talked about. And we're just starting to get the data in now that allows us to assess the impact the economic crisis has had. It appears that the new admissions of people, not in the legal system, but particularly in the undocumented migration, the irregular illegal movements, is down. People from Mexico, Central America, Caribbean have received the word that jobs are scarcer in the United States and that it's risky to come here. And so we're seeing a decrease in the net number of new arrivals into the United States. We've not yet seen a significant increase in return migration. It appears that most immigrants, even if they're facing economic hardships here, are preparing to stay around, weather the economic crisis and make a decision later on as to whether they'll stay or go. And we've got some reduction in new arrivals, not yet a significant number of returnees. But as a result, some of the pressures in terms of illegal migration is reducing largely because of the economic crisis, and largely because the economic crisis has particularly hurt the occupations that many migrants are in, construction, some of the service occupations, which people, when they're in economic decline, those are the first things that you forego: the landscaper, the gardener, that type of activity. What will happen in the recovery, though, is an expectation that much of this immigration will start up again. So what are the challenges? There are many. Let me start with probably what the biggest challenge is today, and that's the large numbers and rate of illegal migration into the country. Before the economic crisis, we had hit a new high in which there were more people coming into the country illegally than were coming into the country legally. And so we had seen a shift where undocumented migration had become the prevalent mode of entry into the United States. Even though the stock is still largely legal, the flow of new people was largely through illegal channels. The challenge in terms of unauthorized migration then is twofold. The first is, what do we do about the future flows, particularly once the economic crisis is over and the economy begins to recover. Is there a way to reduce the numbers of people coming in illegally, either reduce it altogether or channel it into legal immigration systems? And there are two sets of issues with regard to unauthorized migration. The first is, what do we do at the borders of the United States, and particularly the very long border between the U.S. and Mexico? There has been a tendency over the last couple of administrations to try to address illegal migration primarily at the border. Putting in more Border Patrol officers, there was a growth in Border Patrol from a few thousand 15 years ago to, I think, it's 17,000 today. So a huge increase just in law enforcement presence along the border. There's been a great deal of building of walls, of fences between the U.S. and Mexico, and a lot of deployment of technology, sensors, lighting, cameras, various other mechanisms to try to address the movements. I personally, having really looked at this trend over the last 15 years, think it's been largely ineffective. Our new Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, said when she was governor of Arizona, if you build a 6-foot fence, they'll bring a 7-foot ladder. And it's really very, very difficult to be able to use enforcement effectively on a border that is very highly integrated. Communities of families living on both sides of the border and trying to stop movements as a result. And keep in mind the 40-45% who do come in legally and then overstay their visas. Border security is not going to really address that problem. To me, it's the second area that really is potentially much more effective, and that's those are changes that are need to be made at the work site. The vast majority of those who come here illegally are coming for jobs. If one deals with the magnet of employment, you have a lot better chance of dealing with the underlying roots of the unauthorized migration. And there we have a problem in that right now employers are expected to determine who is legally authorized to work in the United States, but neither they nor the government have adequate tools in order to make that decision. I can take you to, if I knew it, the park in Anchorage, I'm sure there is one, in which for about $40, maybe $50, the price is probably a little bit higher here than in the continental U.S., but anybody who's seeking work can purchase a counterfeit Social Security card and driver's license, which will pass muster with any employer in the country, and particularly with an employer who really doesn't want to look very carefully at those documents. Wants to believe that they are legitimate documents because they need the workers or feel that they have a demand for that labor. So one of the major challenges is to develop a system of employment verification that really will allow employers to determine who is legally authorized to work and who isn't. We need enforcement in order to be able to ensure that those who flagrantly violate those provisions are prosecuted, are fined, penalized, particularly if they're doing it in order to exploit the labor. They should be driven out of business. But once we're legitimate employers who have a legitimate need for labor can determine who is legally authorized and not. That in and of itself, though, won't really help unless there are alternatives to get the labor that is needed to meet the labor demand. In some cases, raising wages will do it, and that's something that we should be encouraging. But in other cases, the bodies just aren't there. to do the jobs. And that leads me to my second challenge. What type of reform in our legal admission system do we need in order to ensure that we have access to a legal foreign workforce and not a reliance on those who are here without authorization, who have not been inspected by any government authority and determined to be admissible? We have many flaws in our legal admission system. As I mentioned before, it's heavily geared towards the highly skilled, and many reasons it should be. Generally, some of the greatest benefits to the country come from bringing in good human resources, human talent, that can contribute to economic growth and prosperity. But we also need mechanisms that can test the labor market to determine what is the legitimate needs of employers for low-skilled workers and have mechanisms to bring that low-skilled workforce into the country through legal means. The big debate in immigration reform has been a debate over what numbers are needed, should they be admitted temporarily or permanently, and what rights should they have while they're in the country, either temporarily or permanently? Should they have access to citizenship? So that's part of the debate, part of the challenge is to figure out what the appropriate mechanisms are. And of course, a large number of those who are doing those jobs today are those who are here illegally. And so the next question is not just what do we want for future workers, but what do we do with those who are already in the country working here, but working here illegally? And that's been clearly the most controversial issue in the immigration reform debate. Most experts that I've certainly consulted with, read their work, believe that it would be virtually impossible to remove 12 million people from the United States and be consistent with any of our American values. Some believe that there will be attrition as a result of the economic crisis and the numbers will be lower. As I said, we're not yet really seeing evidence of significant return occurring. And if you buy that logic that deportation is not likely to work to be feasible, attrition it will be only to a small degree, then one is inevitably reaches the point of having to consider what type of legalization program, what type of ways can we regularize the status of those who are here illegally. And there the debate really goes into, again, what are the rights, what's the access of those who are already here to eventual citizenship, and what rights do they have in the interim? Making the situation much more complicated is the fact that most of those who are in the country illegally are living in mixed households with legal permanent residents and U.S. citizens, generally U.S. citizen children. And so one has to think about the issue as a household issue. One of the fascinating statistics that I've just learned about the last few weeks from probably the best expert in terms of the trying to estimate numbers and characteristics of those who are illegally in the country, which of course is a hard thing to do because they don't come by and say, hi, I'm here illegally, count me and ask me questions. So you have to use a lot of different mechanisms to get there. But it appears that people here illegally are more likely to be living in two-parent families with their children than U.S. natives are. So if you think about this population, they really are the epitome of family values. And support those family values very, very well, except, of course, that they have violated the rule of law in order to come here. Maybe good sound reasons, but for a country to have an immigration system where a routine violation of the rule of law is the norm, I think is not what we should be doing. We should be thinking about legal
avenues.
In our legal system, we also need reforms in our mechanisms for admitting family members. We now offer a few visas each year to people who are coming because they have close family members in the United States. But in the case, for example, of the wives, husbands, and minor children of legal permanent residents, there's now, from Mexico, a 5 or 6 year backlog before somebody can actually get the visa. Aren't very many families that are willing to put up with a 5 to 6 year wait to be living with their spouses or their minor children. Not surprisingly, we end up with illegal migration as part of the family reunification process because they wait those 5 or 6 years in the U.S. rather than wait back in Mexico. We have other categories, for example, for brothers and sisters of U.S. citizens, which are even more backlogged. In that case, we are now accepting people who applied about 25 years ago. If you apply today from the Philippines, there are estimates that you might be eligible to enter the country legally in somewhere between 40 and 45 years. The median age, the average age of the principal applicants under that category is 55. Means we keep them out of the country when they're in working age and bring them into the country when they're nearing retirement. Makes no sense. So we need some real fundamental reforms in determining what are our priorities and what numbers are needed each year in order to be able to meet those priorities. The employment system, even for high skilled, it's equally bad. If you have an advanced degree, a master's or a PhD, and your employer has applied for a permanent visa for you and you live in India, it's a 5-year wait. What employer waits 5 years for a needed hire and who has actually demonstrated to the government that there is no U.S. worker who is qualified for that job? And yet the wait is 5 years. So our system is really completely out of whack. The outlines of comprehensive reform are pretty clear. There have been bills introduced over the last several Congresses that have had the components in it. Of course, the devil is always in the detail. But the basic components, generally, of this comprehensive reform are enforcement mechanisms to deal with future flows to try to reduce the number of people entering illegally, some type of regularization for those currently in the country who can demonstrate that they're gainfully employed, are able to support themselves, are paying taxes, etc. And one of the interesting things about the U.S. system compared to most other countries with illegal immigration is that most of our migrants who are here without authorization do pay taxes. And they're not able to claim them back, even though they're very low-wage incomes. It's actually Social Security Trust Fund is benefiting every year from these payments, which nobody will be able to take unless, of course, they are able to regularize their status. So new enforcement, regularization, new legal admission systems for both meeting temporary and permanent labor demand as well as family reunification. And then something that I think is two more issues, one of which I think is extremely important to make the rest of these proposals work, and that's to address the administrative capabilities in the government to actually be able to implement any of these new policies. Right now, those are not there. The immigration services, whether enforcement or benefits, have been woefully underfunded for years and years. Stepchildren of whatever agency they've been part of now are in the Department of Homeland Security. Some of the immigration functions don't really fit very well there. Others are quite appropriate. But we need to be really rethinking the way in which the agencies operate, or else immigration reform will fail just because the administrative load will be so great that it can't succeed. And then my last point, last challenge, is one of immigrant integration. I started off saying that it's really the social impacts of immigration that tend to be the most difficult ones and the most mixed. And part of the challenge there is really related to immigrant children and the children of immigrants, and particularly those whose parents are coming in to do the low-wage, low-skilled work. The millions of people in that category. Unless our public schools are able to address their educational needs more effectively, and we can reduce the dropout rates and can increase the success rates, then we have the potential to have a lingering second-class group of citizens. They are citizens for the most part, but not necessarily doing as well in school and well in terms of their integration into our communities as we, I believe, as a society, need them to do as the future of our society. And so immigrant integration has to be a major part of any immigration reform, not to think in terms only of the mechanisms and the enforcement, but also what happens to the immigrants over the long term. Quickly, prospects for immigration reform. Where do I think it's going? I am very, very nervous that we will have a new debate over immigration that takes place in the context of an economic crisis. Economic crises in the past have generated xenophobic responses, backlash against immigrants, even where there is no competition for jobs. Most of the auto workers being laid off in Detroit are not in competition with Mexican farm workers in California, not likely to be taking those jobs. So it's not that there's a one-on-one competition that goes on in terms of who comes in as immigrants and who are the people most affected by the economic crisis. But yet, in a time of economic uncertainty, there often is a tendency towards protectionism, not just trade protectionism, but people protectionism as well. And while we need a very rational debate, I'm not sure that this is the time or the place to hold that type of discussion about immigration reform. I think what we should do now are incremental steps to address some of the problems that I've talked about, do what we can, well, we're able to, but hold off until we see where the economic recovery is going and how quickly it seems to be taking hold before we divert attention into immigration reform and away from the real fundamentals of the economic recovery, which has little to do with immigration and a lot to do with other economic issues. So I think we need comprehensive immigration reform. I hope we'll phase it in, that we won't end up with a nasty debate on these issues based on emotion rather than reason. And it's actually groups like you who are interested in world affairs and have an interest in understanding the facts and the prospects for economic growth in the United States really have to be at the heart of the discussion that we have when we open up the debate in Congress. Thank you.
You've been listening to Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Dr. Susan Martin, Director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. Following her talk on U.S. immigration policy, challenges for the future, Dr. Martin responded to questions from the audience. First, she was asked, how can there be statistics on illegal immigrants in the United States when they are undocumented?
Okay, my first job in Washington, and I came there 30 years ago to work on immigration, I was given the assignment of coming up with the official U.S. statistic on the number of people in the country illegally. It was not something I sought, not something that I would particularly benefit from. But we got the Census Bureau working on the problem. And it turns out that the U.S. Census and our annual, both the decennial census, but also our annual labor force surveys, the current population survey, do an awfully good job of counting people, regardless of their legal status. And there have been special surveys that let us know what the undercount is. You know, whom have we counted? And what are their characteristics? So we have the total population, pretty good, good numbers on that. And then we have very good data on who comes into the country legally. And we have not so good but okay estimates on who leaves the country. We don't really count people when they go out, but we've got a good history on that and know something about it. We know how many people are born. We know how many people die. Those numbers are done. And so it's a residual method. You take the total population, adjust it for the undercount, subtract those who were legally in the country, legally admitted, those who were born, deal with the deaths, and then the residual number of those who are illegally in the country. And we know from specialized surveys where they tend to be, what types of occupations, and that's applied to that data. And these numbers have held up very well. When the last major amnesties that we've had turned out to be remarkably accurate in terms of what the projections were versus what the actuality was when people were able to step forward. So we know quite a lot in that area now.
Secondly, she was asked to talk about the impact NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Act, had on immigration. Did corn subsidies do anything to improve local economies in Mexico and decrease migration to the United States?
Great question. There was a lot of analysis done before NAFTA as to what the impact would be on migration. And the consensus was that in the long term, it would reduce migration from Mexico as the Mexican economy would take off, begin to grow based on its ability to export products to the U.S. So in the long term, pretty good deal. In the short to medium term, though, the consensus was that NAFTA would increase immigration pressures from Mexico, partly because not just of the corn subsidies, but the tariffs on corn came off. And Mexican farmers who were subsistence farmers growing corn for themselves and a little bit for their communities couldn't compete with Iowa corn. Once NAFTA eliminated the tariffs. And Mexico had to make a lot of other reforms in its agricultural system that, in effect, pushed people off the farm. Needed to happen at some point as part of the development process. Most countries can't sustain too high a percentage of its population in agriculture. But it occurred before there was growth in other forms of employment in Mexico. And in fact, we've seen exactly what was predicted happen. That as soon as at that once NAFTA started to take hold, immigration from Mexico increased exponentially. It happened during a time of economic boom in the United States, and most experts think that the U.S. economy is actually the larger factor than the Mexican economy in terms of the numbers. What will happen in the long term is still to be seen because, there's a famous saying, that the U.S. hiccups and Mexico gets pneumonia. You know, it's I've forgotten the exact wording on it, but you know, anything that happens in terms of our economy has much, much larger impacts on Mexico and how soon it takes them to recover from this financial and economic crisis is unclear. I'm fairly optimistic that Mexico is on the right track and that in the next generation will see a turnaround and Mexico will produce enough jobs for its workforce, and the pressures to emigrate will not be as great. But if you asked me how long it would take, I would hazard no guesses at this point.
Next, another audience member asked, are there any countries that have workable immigration policies that the United States can follow as a model?
There are three major traditional immigration countries, U.S., Canada, and Australia. Canada and Australia, in many respects, do a better job of managing their immigration than we do. But they're also much smaller countries, and they're more manageable in terms of the population, although they have a higher percentage of their population who are foreign-born. But Australia is an island. Canada has the U.S. in between. You know, most of the rest of the world and its borders, so it has a little bit easier time than we do. You know, for all of the challenges I've said, and I think they're deep and they're great concern, we always have to keep in mind, though, that the U.S. does a phenomenally good job of integrating newcomers, that it's never easy. We've always worried about it. But we have in place, I think, some of the best policies and structures for integrating immigrants of any country. Birthright citizenship is hugely powerful. Unlike other countries, you know, an immigrant is only an immigrant for one generation. The children born in the United States are citizens. You know, there may be racial or religious or ethnic discrimination, but they're citizens and they can demand their rights. We don't have immigrants into the second, third, fourth generation, as many other countries do. And we have very, very strong system, anti-discrimination systems that apply, most of them, unfortunately, because of racial discrimination for many years, but most of them apply for immigrants as well. So there are legal mechanisms that immigrants have. We have had a very good public education system, and the public education system has been the champion of immigrant integration for most of our history. I'd like to see our schools doing more with the parents of immigrants, with English classes in the evening, literacy courses. One of the things we've found in some of the research we've done is that the best way to ensure the child learns English is to bring the parent into the school. And that has huge implications for the entire family, and particularly bringing the mothers into the school. Getting them out of the household and into learning English does tremendous things for the children's education. So we know what to do. We've done it well in the past. We're doing it well in many, many communities throughout the country. And I think it's those lessons, both from the past and from the communities that are already doing well, that need to be spread. Yes, we need to learn from Canada, Australia, other countries, but we have a lot of our own lessons that we could be applying.
A few weeks back, a speaker at the Alaska World Affairs Council warned that we, namely Judeo-Christians, were in great danger because we are underproducing babies. Meanwhile, others, who he explicitly indicated to be a part of the Muslim community, were overproducing babies. The audience member explained why she disagreed with the speaker's point of view, asking Dr. Martin, how do we combat this xenophobia?
Well, I think I disagree with his premises. The U.S. actually has the highest birth rate of any industrialized country. We're over the number that's needed in order to maintain our current population size. And it's partly because of immigration, and he's right that immigrants have tended to have higher fertility than natives have. But native fertility is quite high as well relative to Italy, for example, which has 1.2 children per woman, which means they're well below replacement rates. And so I'm not sure his demographic information necessarily holds, but I tend not to necessarily connote those types of statements necessarily with xenophobia. I think there can be, clearly there is xenophobia, and it's something I worry about. But I think there are also very legitimate concerns about the changes that immigration is happening to the country. And again, there were concerns when my father came as a young boy at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, there were concerns about, you know, all of these Jews coming from Russia and Poland. They were changing our Judeo-Christian by adding the Judeo part of it on that. So, you know, there's always been concerns of this type about changing religion. You know, the Irish Catholics, my God, you know, they were considered to be a fifth column that was going to, you know, bring the Pope to rule America on that. So this, it's always been a part of us. And I think teaching that history is important, to know that, you know, your grandparents or parents or grandparents or great-grandparents were the subject of exactly that thought and those statements. And I think too many Americans don't remember that and don't understand that connection. But I think we also have to deal with the realities. Too high a proportion of our immigration is illegal. I don't think that's healthy for a country. We should be making decisions about who can enter, and we should have the ability to enforce those decisions. When people talk about, you know, that this is a violation, this violation of our law, they're right. And that's not how we should be running an immigration system. On the other hand, I think we also have to have the mechanisms to figure out what is the legitimate demand, and have legal systems that meet that. And my experience is that when the American public believes seriously that the government is acting responsibly and managing immigration, we tend to be much more supportive of immigration itself. It's when we think it's out of control, and in fact it is out of control, that we have every right to be angry. But the solution isn't to blame the migrants who have come in, particularly when they're doing jobs that we want them to be doing. You know, my gardener is great, but it's all of those others who are the problem. I mean, we hear that all the time on that. So I think it's to deal with the real problems in our immigration system. That's our best way of warding off xenophobic responses. If we're doing a better job managing immigration, then it's much, much harder to scapegoat the immigrants for the failures in our own policies.
Another audience member said she agreed with Dr. Martin that xenophobia occurs when there is protectionism, which many would say is occurring right now all over the United States, from homes being raided by the government to the horrific conditions occurring at the Mexico border. An audience member asked Dr. Martin, what do you say to those who feel a sense of urgency to respond to this xenophobia?
Yeah, I think that the strategies that have been used over the last 4 or 5 years are highly destructive and ineffectual. I mean, I don't think they should be used even if they were effective, but given the combination that they, from a humanitarian point of view, they're really pretty bad, and from an effects point of view, they're not there on it. And yet, but I'm not sure that I would necessarily attribute xenophobia as the reason. I think it's more desperation on the part of the government, that the Bush administration had proposed immigration reform, appear to be in favor of it, and were actually stopped by their own party the Republican opposition in Congress. And the reaction, once the more comprehensive approach, which would have included legalization and new as well as new enforcement, failed, the response from the Department of Homeland Security was, well, if you don't want to do it properly, we'll do it our way. And our way was, again, building more fences, doing more raids, both worksite and border raids, ratcheting up the visibility of the problem through that type of horrific situation. So I think it was actually done on a very rational basis, but drawing the wrong lesson from the failure to pass immigration reform. And so, yes, the Minutemen, there are xenophobic, you know, far out people who are on the border doing wacky things, but I don't think that's the norm. But I think what we do have is a government that really doesn't know what it's doing, and therefore not doing a very good job. And yes, immigration reform is necessary for that reason, but it needs to be the right immigration reform and not one that makes matters worse rather than better.
I see there has been some backlash surrounding the wall being built at the United States-Mexico border, another audience member stated. What is the current status of the wall at our border?
The current status is that most of it is up or getting up, and that most of those legal protests have failed, that the courts are very, very loath to interfere when the federal government is using a national security argument in defense of a policy, which has been the case. The deaths along the border are awful. Unfortunately, they're not new, and they're not just as a result of the fences. When I first started to spend a lot of time on the San Diego border, before some of the fencing went up, there were actually an equal number or more deaths that were occurring, but they were people coming up I-5, the main highway, and being hit by cars, or people being attacked by roving bandits on the border. And the numbers, actually, of deaths were pretty similar. It's just what's happened is that those deaths have shifted. They should have been reduced. I mean, that would have been the appropriate response. Instead, the response was to shift them much more out of sight and out of mind. And there's been an increase. One of the results of the building of the fences and the other border security has been a full employment for smugglers bill, in effect, that what ends up happening is that people can't get over by themselves anymore, so they're spending more money paying smugglers to help them get into the country. The smugglers are bringing them through riskier and riskier terrain in order to be able to circumvent the border buildup. It increases the cost. It means that the migrants actually have to stay in the U.S. for longer in order to earn back the money it's cost them to pay the smugglers. And so we've gotten to a cycle of not addressing the problem, which is jobs. Nothing we do at the border is going to address the illegal migration problem. People are going to find ways around it unless we deal rationally with both enforcement and access to new admissions programs at the work site. And unfortunately, in the meantime, you know, people died 20 years ago and people are dying today. And it's not a good situation.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Dr. Susan Martin, Director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. She responded to questions from the audience following her talk entitled U.S. Immigration Policy, Challenges for the Future, recorded in Anchorage on May 29, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. visit KSKA.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at KSKA.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.